Father Mankowski was ordained a Jesuit in 1987 and is currently a doctoral candidate in comparative Semitic philology at Harvard University. He has an A.B. in Classics and Philosophy from the University of Chicago, a B.A. and an M.A. in Classics and Philosophy from Oxford University, and a Master's in Divinity from the Weston School of Theology, where he was also an instructor in biblical languages. He has been a teaching fellow at Harvard and an assistant professor at the Pontifical Biblical Institute in Rome. He also is a writer of articles. You may have seen some of his articles in Crisis, in the Homiletic and Pastoral Review, and other periodicals. I find that his writing is intelligent, it's insightful, it's clear, and it's forceful. He also is a good lecturer. I've heard him lecture at the college. He spoke also for Thomas Aquinas College at a dinner in Chicago in November. I just wish one thing. I wish he'd learn how to say what's on his mind. But it's my pleasure again to introduce Father Paul Mankowski.
Unsex me here. Lady Macbeth's prayer, significantly, was made to the gods of death, you spirits that tend on mortal thoughts. And we remember, with a shudder, how completely and vividly her wish was granted. She was, largely, though not entirely, a contrivance of fiction. And yet Shakespeare's powerful and grisly anti-heroine was a forerunner of a species of Christian for whom the conjunction of prayer, personal resolve, and the negation of life produced a radically new thing, a third order of sexuality, a way of being human that is neither authentically male nor recognizably female, neither inceptive nor receptive of life, neither ordered to creation nor designed to nurture. Unsex me here. It is important to notice that when Lady Macbeth prays that she be unsexed, she is pleading not for a diminishment of lust, sexual libido, but for freedom from compassion. The juices of sexual frenzy may flow unchecked. It is the promptings of motherhood that must be ripped clean away. Come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for gall, you murdering ministers, wherever in your sightless substances you wait on nature's mischief. The upshot is that it is not lust, but life that must be alienated from the votaries of this third order of the unsexed. I've been asked to address the question this morning, how has the contraceptive mentality affected religious life? It has, emphatically. For the rest of my time, I wish to deal with the prayer of Lady Macbeth and the paradox of celibate men and women recentering their lives on a contraceptive worldview. This contraceptive mentality is much more than the conviction that artificial birth control is morally licit. It comprises an entire fabric of attitudes about sin, religious authority, human fulfillment, as well as sexuality, attitudes that are determinative of choices central to every human life, including those for whom personal fertility and infertility are utterly irrelevant issues. Contraceptive acts and their moral condemnation are equally ancient. As is well known, the contraceptive crisis was brought into being with the development in the 1960s of orally administered anovulants, the pill, or as it is irreverently known in Britain, the tablet, focused the moral issues and polarized the champions of rival solutions decisively and irrevocably. This was not simply or even primarily the consequence of what is misleadingly called the sexual revolution brought on by the pill. The sexual revolution was no revolution at all, but a normal operation of the moral laws of gravity. Folks done more of what they done before, simply because one constraint, fear of unwanted pregnancy, was eased. The water of sexual libido ran downhill after a sluice gate was widened. No surprise there. No, the real revolution occasioned by the pill was not sexual, but religious. Sexual sins have generally, and with reason, been treated by moralists of all traditions as sins of the weakness of will, of akrasia, or intemperance. Pagan, Christian, Muslim, and Jew knew equally well that it's wrong for the head of the household to dally with the dairy maid, but recognized that in a moment of weakness, a man generally resolved to live uprightly could succumb to temptation. Theologies of remorse, penance, and reconciliation varied widely, but all understood the phenomenon of lust mastering the moment. The pill changed all that. To contracept by this method involved not a surrender to the mood of an instant, but an action, or better, a series of actions, clearly foreseen and assented to in cold blood, passionlessly, with deliberation and resolve. The majority of the report of Paul VI's Commission on Birth Control clumsily attempted to assimilate the contraceptive pill to the class of morally dubious actions undertaken impulsively. But this concession was rightly rejected with scorn by Catholic couples who forthrightly admitted that the choice to contracept is embarked on as a consciously and, by their own lights, conscientiously planned decision. To those who had made their peace with the pill, the shock delivered by Humana Vitae was staggering. It still is. "Unsex me here," begged Lady Macbeth. "Make thick my blood. Stop up the access and passage to remorse, that no compunctious visitings of nature shake my fell purpose, nor keep peace between the effect and it." This is not a person trying to justify the ill means to a contemplated good end, or someone asking for pardon after the fact for an acknowledged wrongdoing. She prays to be rid of the passage to remorse, to get beyond questions of conscience entirely. She resolved to be fixed on her purpose and on it alone, to the exclusion of all other considerations. Once the Church included the choice to contracept by means of the pill in the class of morally condemned actions, no Catholic could repeatedly confess the sin of contracepting as an occasion of weakness of will. To contracept while attempting to remain a Catholic required the development of an entirely novel religious framework. Two components. First, the conviction that the Catholic Church is wrong in an area in which it explicitly claims authority. And second, the conviction that an individual can coherently believe the Church to be wrong in one area and right, or right enough, in others, such that membership in the Church remains a meaningful and conscientious choice. Now, even on the pastoral level, very few religious were directly affected by the face value content of Humanae Vitae. Yet the religious framework that emerged in the rejection of Humanae Vitae was absolutely central to their lives. For it involves, first of all, the belief that there is a higher or deeper, or at any rate, more reliable mediator of God's will than the teaching Church. It is impossible to stress this point too much. If the Church is wrong in Humanae Vitae, the judgment that it is wrong must be made in accordance with some standard. And that standard, obviously, cannot be the Church itself. Some contend it is moral intuition. Others, a more academically respectable reading of Scripture or of the history of doctrine. Still others, some paramount system of ethics or logic. But the crucial point is that whatever standard is taken as fundamentally reliable, this standard judges the church and is not judged by it. Here is the real revolution incited by the pill. Next to it, the rise in promiscuity is a mere flutter. And religious men and women instinctively realized, and in many cases rushed toward, the breach in the dam caused by the adoption of this new standard. Keep in mind that this new crisis is of an entirely different order from the classical moral controversies in the history of the church, such as the Donatist heresy or the Jansenist controversy. For these involved the laxity and rigor of the church's treatment of what all parties to the dispute agreed to be sins. Augustine insisted as much as any Donatist that denial of Christ was gravely immoral. The argument concerned those who, after the fact, were acknowledged to be sinners and attempted to re-enter the church without rebaptism. Similarly, Jesuit and Jansenist had no disagreement about what counted as sinful. Rather, they disputed the conditions required to give absolution. But the dissenters from Humanae Vitae are about something else entirely. For they maintain that an action specifically and categorically condemned by the church may be contemplated before the fact and chosen in goodwill as a licit option by a conscientious Catholic. Now, suppose for a moment that a Catholic comes to believe that the teaching church is wrong in condemning contraception, but right about everything else. Implausible, but let's assume that. How does he judge the church wrong in the one case? As we have seen, by reference to some standard that is more reliable than the church. But how does he judge the church to be right in the other million and one instances? Obviously, only in virtue of the same standard by which he judged her defective. It is absurd, not to say insane, to claim that one obeys or is faithful to the church in those areas in which he happens to agree with her, because happens to agree is the operative phrase. If my pocket calculator has proven unreliable in one calculation, I might still maintain that I can depend on it for others. But my basis for depending on it cannot be the calculator itself. It's already proved itself flawed. I may decide my calculator has, let's say, a glitch in the square root function, but is sound in all others. But this judgment can only be made by reliance on what I am convinced is a better instrument, or a sound mathematical table, or my own longhand reckonings. The point I want to stress is that once I have found a more reliable instrument, the less reliable one is utterly superfluous, worthless, in fact. I can only hang on to it out of sentimental reasons. By the same token, once my religious experience or my theory of ethics has proven more reliable than the church, even in a single instance, I can only pretend to let myself be taught by the church in other matters. My loyalty will be a gesture of sentimental affection, not an act of discipleship. The contracepting Catholic who, for example, claims to be faithful to the church on social doctrine is in the position of a British Prime Minister who is summoned by the Queen. His elevation to be her Prime Minister, her chief advisor, is in reality a matter of hardball, backroom, democratic political caucusing, ceremonially tricked out as an act of the royal will. Is the Prime Minister obeying the monarch in answering her summons? Only in the vacuous sense that a person can say yes to his own invitation. The contraceptive mentality, then, makes the hierarchical church into something like the British monarchy. It is an antiquated ceremonial instrument for injecting a certain pomp into the solemnization of decisions one has made on grounds wholly unrelated to its logic, purposes, and desires. For the vowed religious, The first casualty of the contraceptive mentality is the church as the focus of religious authority. The realization, perhaps, was gradual, and the full impact has only made itself felt recently. But when prominent theologians, bishops, and entire episcopal conferences distance themselves from Humanae Vitae without severing themselves from the church, the logic of their dissent could hardly be confined to this single issue. In an astonishingly brief span of years, the church has been transformed from the measuring rod to the thing measured. No longer the guarantor of authentic religious life, she is everywhere under suspicion. In liturgy, scripture, pastoral efforts, theology, and sacrament, the church is regarded by entire congregations of religious as guilty until proven innocent. And this proof of innocence is seldom forthcoming. In the days when contraception was an unreliable affair, and pregnancy was a common consequence of sexual relations, extramarital sex involved a clear offense against charity, and the teachings forbidding adultery and fornication were easily defended on these grounds. Too easily, in fact. Moreover, the obvious mechanical instrumentation of older methods of contraception lent weight, although a specious one, to the argument of preachers that artificial birth control was contrary to nature. Once again, the advent of the pill obliterated both defenses, and the church's teaching on the spiritual significance of marriage, the body, and sexuality were put into the hands of teachers who were, for the most part, wholly unprepared to understand or communicate them. Dissenters, on the other hand, pounced on this opportunity and placed enormous rhetorical stress on the primacy of charity in the church's moral tradition. No one could deny the centrality of charity in this tradition, but the dissenters urged the battle on the popular front by pushing two erroneous propositions. First, that an act that is not a sin against charity is no sin at all. And second, that any act done with a charitable intention was ipso facto justified. The application to married life virtually wrote itself. Contraception involved no obvious sin against charity, for neither husband nor wife was wounded, and therefore it involved no sin at all. Or again, if contraception was employed with a charitable intention, making life easier for the parents, ensuring more advantages for children, it was morally praiseworthy. The theological justification for these arguments, however, necessitated a reformulation of the traditional Catholic notion of charity and moral reasoning. In this view, the morally preferable option is not the one that conforms to some principle of human conduct, but the one that results in more good, that is, more pre-moral good, than its rivals. It takes little imagination to devise scenarios in which contraception will result in more pre-moral goods than rival options, and therefore contraception was handily made available as a morally licit choice. The dissenters on Humanae Vitae did not, of course, state their claims as crudely as I have done, and they did accompany their arguments with a cataract of quotations from St. Thomas and other traditional doctors, purporting to show that they stood well within the tradition they were going to overturn. Yet the chasm that separates these dissenters from Orthodox Catholics has been described with unique felicity and precision by the Oxford philosopher John Finnis, who writes that while it was the belief of the Orthodox tradition of the Church that we are to serve the good, the dissenters hold that our duty is to effect the good. Often the way of doing the former is to do the latter, but not always, and that's the crunch. Now, whereas the belief that our moral duty is to effect the good has been used by Catholic theologians to justify abortion, euthanasia, the manufacture of babies, and the threatened destruction of civilian populations as a deterrent, it is Finnis's opinion that contraception provided the real impulse behind the advancement of this theory. And indeed, it is the justification of contraception that continues to provide the focal unity of dissent in the church. Consider once again all that is consequent upon the change from serving the good to affecting the good. Call to mind the direction of change in religious communities and apostolic involvement in the past 25 years. The de-emphasis on adoration, catechesis, spiritual works of mercy, even that term seems comically antiquated, the new stress on consciousness raising, political action, community organizing, world peace, environmental awareness. Call to mind further the rationale commonly given by religious men and women for their entanglements in the compromises and their morally dubious complicity in the scandals of moral and public life, the excuses and justifications offered by priests and nuns acting as university officials and elected or appointed agents of state for their actions that are contrary to church teaching. Is it not the case, almost without exception, that their plea is to a higher responsibility to affect the good rather than to serve it? Is it not the case that those whose aim is to cause a certain effect regard their more scrupulous brothers and sisters with Lady Macbeth's exasperation? Yet I do fear thy nature. It is too full of the milk of human kindness to catch the nearest way. Thou wouldst be great, art not without ambition, but without the illness should attend it. What thou wouldst highly, thou wouldst holily. Thou wouldst not play false, and yet wouldst wrongly win. Thou hast great glams, that which cries, thus must thou do if thou have it, and that which rather thou dost fear to do than wished should be undone. Translated into contemporary terms, the message runs thus: only weaklings let moral principles stand in the way of social change. You can accomplish nothing great if you let yourself be trapped by the snare of holiness. If you're going to succeed, you have to regard success as the only gauge of morality. True charity, after all, is not serving the good, but delivering the goods. And so it goes, step by step, on a gradual downslope in the lives of religious. Faith in God gives way to the faith that does justice, which in turn gives way to justice which brings itself into being, which turns out, in practical terms, to mean an ideology of justice that must dispense with faith when faith would hinder its full realization. Thus, in the span of 25 years, the voices that urged us to follow the patriarch Moses in his exodus of liberation now urge us to believe that patriarchy, indeed that very law by which Moses justified himself, comprises the final and most dire obstacle to true human freedom. The God of the patriarchs is worse than the bondage of Pharaoh. I've pointed to two revolutions in Catholic religious life that were precipitated by the rise of the contraceptive mentality. The first was doctrinal, what Father Patrick Collins, the Vincentian, called the change from the experience of religious authority to the authority of religious experience, the demotion of the church from judge to defendant. The second revolution was moral, the change from serving the good to affecting the good. The third revolution might broadly be called spiritual. From the earliest days of the church, Christian life has involved asceticism, a regimen of spiritual discipline whereby foregoing the comforts and consolations of bodily life was regarded as training for a life of holiness leading to eternal life with God. We can distinguish two strands within this tradition: what we might call asceticism of acceptance or patience, and the asceticism of renunciation. Asceticism of patience asks us to accept with joyful resolve the unavoidable hardships of life, those from which there is no escape, as a sharing in the blessedness of the world's poor and as a way to perfection. Physical deformity, the hardships of war, the pain of an infertile marriage are all examples of these austerities. Asceticism of renunciation involves those hardships that are not inevitable, but are undertaken either in conformity to moral principle or as a wholly gratuitous means of discipline aimed at holiness. Now, the meaningfulness of the asceticism of renunciation is a precarious thing because it flies in the face of humanistic theories of self-actualization and personal fulfillment. Theories which see voluntary renunciation of a human good not only as absurd, but as pestilent, as pathological. Noble acceptance of unavoidable suffering, say the death of one's child, is often seen as a growth experience in these views, in these psychologies. But to court suffering, to voluntarily choose suffering, is depraved. Once again, before the advent of reliable contraception, Catholic couples could plausibly be urged to accept the various disciplines of married love as part of an asceticism of patience. With the availability of the pill, the ground changed overnight to the requirement to accept the asceticism of renunciation, because the twin hardships of sexual abstinence and provision for large families became easily, eminently avoidable. For a while, the question hung precariously in the balance. Would Catholic couples accept the Church's discipline and the new invitation to an asceticism of renunciation, or would they opt for the techno fix and push voluntary asceticism to the margins of their lives? Not for the first time, they looked to their clergy and their religious, those set apart and coached in asceticism, for their clues on how to respond to the two new offers. Even at this date, I find it impossible to believe that a spirited and joyful embrace of Humanae Vitae by clergy and religious, combined with sound instruction and spiritual aid to the laity, would not have resulted in a general Catholic adherence to this new mode of asceticism. It didn't happen that way. With a vehemence that outdid the most truculent layman, Catholic clergy and religious led the charge against Humanae Vitae, and I would wager that even today, given 100 priests and religious and 100 random laymen between the ages of 55 and 65, you'll find more support for Humanae Vitae in the latter group than the former, by far. Re-enter Lady Macbeth. Naught's had, all spent, where our desire is got without content. 'Tis safer to be that which we destroy than by destruction dwell in doubtful joy. Was it merely coincidence that the massive descent from Humanae Vitae marched with a near total abandonment of the asceticism of renunciation in religious life? I can't offer a proof for my hunch, but I doubt it. Even in the crises of the Reformation, there was no sea change in religious discipline of communities that remained Roman Catholic comparable to the disappearance of fasting, vigils, corporal mortification, penitential labor, and even time set aside for prayer from the lives of all but a few contemporary religious. Certainly, there was a variety of forces set in motion by the aftermath of Vatican II that contributed to the refashioning of religious life, and it would be simplistic and simply wrong to point to the rejection of Humanae Vitae as the fons et origo of every ill. But once human sexuality became assimilated to the number of satisfactions whose exercise belonged to the prerogative of the self-actualized individual, and was consequently emancipated from any larger system of meaning and responsibility, the denial to the self of any and all satisfactions, pleasures, and consolations seemed equally pointless. The notion of rigorous training, this is the ascesis from which the term asceticism comes, vanished in favor of a variety of developmental schemes of monitored growth in which the underlying assumption was contrary to the older via perfectionis. In the new scheme, all men are born good, naturally holy, and required only opportunities for education, self-expression, and enrichment of experience in order to become godlike. The railings and banisters and fences and other boundary safeguards of religious life were discarded, implying as they did a human tendency to sin. Gone is the rule of text.